David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks, and welcome to episode 357. I'm your host, Steve Raker, stuck here in the comic book bunker with nothing but a wall of long boxes and Dr. Doom's time machine to keep me entertained.
Wow.
And that's why I've called in Andrew the LA Rabbit and Whirlwind X Kevin to keep me from creating alternate timelines at every turn.
I don't know why you would want to go to alternate timelines.
Yeah, or if you want to, Steve, you get like earlier versions of Kevin and I.
Oh. You'd be one where Kevin doesn't talk about Thunderbolts, being a fan and stuff like that.
Marvel Noise is the podcast sponsored by nobody. You can find new episodes and archived episodes on marvelnoise.com. You can get new episode announcements and see image galleries and give us feedback on our Facebook and Twitter pages. And listen to the other fine shows on the Deliberate Noise Network, like DC Noise and Comic Book Noise and Noise Noise. You get the idea. Oh, don't forget about Indie Comic Book Noise, our other favorite noise, because that's where we, the Marvel Noise guys, talk about the indie comic books that we're digging on. Although that's become Andrew and Kevin's baby. And sometimes I can make it to tea time and other times can't.
Yeah, is Phil on there more than you now?
Yeah, I was going to say, Phil's really the person responsible for all the controversial decisions.
The spiritual leader of indie comic book noise.
The spirit animal, the otter, the gentle beast.
We haven't talked, we've had all of these Tomb of Dracula chunks of issues to get through in the last month as we got Halloween-y. We haven't talked recent reads in quite some time. I mean, we haven't talked like at all about comic books together, it seems, in a while. So I'm looking forward to a big recent reads roundtable here. A cornucopia of comics coming from left and right. From the Bronze Age, the Modern Age.
There's so many more that we're not going to cover tonight. I feel like I have another stack for like next episode. There's definitely going to be some that will get blown over.
Oh, you think you've got a bunch. We're not even going to touch on the giant stacks of 2099 books I've been hauling off of eBay. So,
are we going to have to go weekly here or what with this podcast?
I mean, it would help for a while. Sometimes... This is sad, but sometimes it's like you're just saving those books or whatever, and it's like if it wasn't for the podcast, I kind of wonder if I would get to certain things.
Understood. I have those moments too. Like, if I can't talk about it on the podcast, am I really going to read this book?
Exactly. Or I'm buying something, and I'm like, oh, I can talk about this on the podcast, so I'll definitely buy this. And then I'm like, wait a second, what's happening here?
That goes in the business expense category.
Exactly.
That happens to me when I feel like rereading like a chunk of old like DC books or revisiting like a DC title where it's like, if I can't talk about it on Marvel Noise and I can't talk about it on Indie Noise, you know, should I really be spending my time doing this?
Well, have you even really read it if you can't talk about it?
I used to read my stack like, not necessarily what I was most interested in, but, oh, what's going to be spoiled? And now it's like, also, it's like, well, DC or some other company, or some other type of reading, I'm like, well, yeah, this is never going to come up on a podcast. So that, like, goes towards the bottom of the stack, and it's like the stack's been rearranged.
Well, you know me, I've always said I sometimes need a spoiler to kind of break my inertia and get me to... move something up on the queue and get excited about reading something, you know? And although we're pretty good on this show, when we talk about modern books, we don't talk about spoilers, although we will talk about what characters appear in books so that fans of characters can say, oh, you know, the White Knight shows up in that book or whatever.
Crime Buster, Steve.
Crime Buster. Make your checklist now. But when we talk about old books, we tend to give spoilers because we're more just goofing on enjoying the content of stuff, you know, 40-year-old books. And I think lately I've been kind of focused on enjoying Bronze Age comics and their sentiments. The same holds true for tonight. Even though we're doing recent reads and I've got a bunch of modern books to share, I did go back and look at a few old Marvel 2-in-1 books. First, because I was looking at old appearances of Moon Knight, and then because Andrew likes to always read the issue before and the issue after whatever issue I suggest, and often find some other good gems that way. Marvel 2-in-1 number 50 was an interesting issue because it's from the winter of 1979, and it's an early case of Byrne writing. Written by Byrne, drawn by Byrne, and inked by Joe Sinnott. I mean, you guys, how great is Joe Sinnott over Byrne on Fantastic Four-related material, right?
Oh, man, that thing is just... That's my thing.
Lumpy thing is your thing?
I like that thing. Yeah, I like the lumpy thing.
Wow.
I mean, I'm okay with pineapple thing.
Oh, jeez.
I assume those are the two types of things. I don't... The OG smooth lumpy thing is less of my jam. But yeah, I like the rocky, craggy kind of big, thick lines between the plates. And Joe Sinnott, you know, he was there from... practically from the get-go.
Yeah. Or is it more oatmeal-y sometimes? It's not so much lumpy, but like oatmeal.
That's what I think. Well, lumpy oatmeal as far for that old Kirby original thing look.
I mean, I was always a little... felt that Marvel 2-in-1 was a little disingenuous, given the Marvel Revolution happened with the split books, and then they have a book called 2-in-1, and then you get it, and there's only one story in it. I always felt that was kind of, you know... faking us out a little bit.
Yeah, I thought it was cool that that was a second team-up book, that of course Spider-Man would have a team-up book, right? The Marvel team-up. But who's the other guy who matches up great with everybody? I mean, he knows everybody and gets along with everybody in the Marvel Universe. It's the Thing. And using the Fantastic Four and their connection to other characters and place in the Marvel Universe as a linchpin for various stories really... works out nicely, I think, and for 100 issues, worked out pretty good.
Yeah,
out of all of them, that's what's really I feel nice. The Thing is the best. I mean, the Torch had those solo stories for a while, Steve, and back in the split book days.
Yeah, well, we talked about how the Torch was like the next, besides Spider-Man, he was the next most common character to appear in the Marvel team-up books, both teaming up with Spider-Man and headlining with another character. So, you know, if it's not going to be Spider-Man or The Thing, like the next in line as far as easy to team up with everybody is the Torch for sure. Also, it shouldn't pass over that it's a George Perez Joe Sinnott cover on this book, which makes it pretty snazzy because it's Perez, Sinnott, and Byrne all in the same book. Pretty cool. It's The Thing and The Thing for Marvel 2-in-1 issue 50. And it's funny because it opens with Reed and Ben doing the usual, you know, sorry, I failed again to change you back into a human dance. But there's a twist because Reed's latest formula would have worked on early lumpy oatmeal Thing, but not on the more evolved Rocky Grim Thing.
Uh-uh.
Even cooler about this issue is that, believe it or not, this is the first acknowledgement in the comics of the Thing's appearance having changed from those first Kirby issues. He didn't get Rocky until around Fantastic Four number 10. Before that, he was the more lumpy variety, and it was just a case of Kirby's style changing and finding what he, you know, what he wanted to do visually with the character. But here, you know, leave it to Byrne to make Kirby's style change part of the continuity narrative. I mean, give that man a no prize, right?
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of a Star Trek episode where they acknowledge that the Klingons used to look differently.
Right.
I mean, I like the story, and I don't want this to come off as a swipe, but it did have that kind of inventory story feel, like they were, you know, there was some ongoing threads here and there, often in two and one and, you know, two parters and things like that. It was mostly standalone, but this one felt, did kind of, I liked it, you know, quality art team, fun story, but it was weird to have the 50th be kind of this, I don't know, it just felt more inventory to me than kind of what's going on.
I think that it did have to be more of a standalone tale because of the fact that it was issue 50, more people were going to pick it up, and it had the guest writer. So, you know, Byrne didn't write the issues before or after. He wouldn't write an issue until the Fantastic... He would start writing Fantastic Four, and that'd be after he would pencil it for a while and then leave and then come back. It's a self-contained issue, for sure. But I get the anniversary thing of it being the thing, right? Pun intended.
Well, so his history... Like, it's interesting that the team-up is thing and thing... And that's kind of a fun way for a book celebrating the thing to have. And it's a big, you know, it goes back to that, the other Saw that they really kind of got away from eventually, but the He Wants to Be Human, which was really driving how many of the stories from right. the '60s up through whenever. And I can't think of the last time he was like, dang it, Reed, when are you going to make me go human?
This issue was part of him learning to be comfortable in his own skin. I mean, that was what made this an anniversary issue. It was the thing teaming up with himself, but it was, you know, the journey, even though it was external, it was also internal, right? I mean, once Reed leaves, Ben sneaks using Dr. Doom's time platform, which is, again, another staple of Marvel Bronze Age stories. Use Doom's time machine to do something. And he travels here back before Fantastic Four number 3. And we know that because he sees Reed touring the Baxter building and they move in Fantastic Four 3.
He should have picked a time when after they had met Dr. Doom, though.
Well, he needs to get to early Ben, right? The lumpy gravy Ben, who he meets, and this Ben has an attitude, and he whoops our Ben pretty good. And then our Ben kind of turns around and then trashes Lumpy Ben. And gives him a punch that totally needed a splash page, you know? Then he forcibly gives him the antidote, and it turns him human, but when Ben, our thing, returns to our present, he's discouraged to find out that he hasn't changed his own future by changing his past. Right, and Reed explains what we have come to know as part of how Marvel Comics works, which is you don't change your present by changing the past, you just create a divergent, alternate timeline.
Yes, one where they probably get taken over by Dr. Doom, because Ben's not there to save him.
But he does come out of the whole experience being more comfortable in his own skin, because at least he doesn't look like that other guy. You know? Yeah.
I thought that was kind of mean-spirited, where he just relentlessly insults his old appearance in a way. But I like that there's also the... I thought they were going to go is the suggestion that his use of that serum back then actually kind of screwed him up now, is how I thought they were going to go.
Right, right, right.
And that, oh, because they make a reference to how in the old days he would sometimes turn human again. Because that was a storyline and a couple of fun ones. And he wore the Great Thing suit that we all remember.
But it's funny what you said about him not being there and how that timeline would be different. There was a sequel to this story, Andrew.
Oh, I missed that one.
That would be the coda to the whole series. Marvel 2-in-1 number 100. Which is The Thing and Ben Grimm. 4 years later, in the spring of 1983... Also written by Byrne, with Ron Wilson, who was the regular pencil of the series, as the penciler. And this one's titled Aftermath. And like I said, it's the last ish, so it's kind of cool that it would go back to this, as you said, filler issue. And it's cool. The splash page is a recreation of that finishing punch. I mean, it still takes a splash page to show it.
Yeah, why not? It's a great page.
Reed learns that Ben, he didn't create an alternate reality in Marvel 2 and 1 number 50, but rather he had been shunted sideways to another dimension. So he basically was in a what-if world. And once Reed leaves, he promised Sue yet another night out on the town, the Thing decides to pay that world another visit and discovers it being windy and desert dry with the infrastructure in ruins. It's a mess. The world has been basically destroyed. So we get like a whole what-if story in 5 pages of recap as he finds Ben Grimm and he tells the Thing that without him, the Thingless Fantastic Four couldn't stop Galactus. Well, what about the Silver Surfer? The Silver who? There was no Silver Surfer in this world. And the world had its life sucked from it after all the heroes fell in front of Galactus. And now the world is run by the Red Skull. So almost, it wasn't Doom, it was the Skull.
Ooh.
And because the Thing, without the Thing arguing with Johnny, that made Johnny run off in a storm, in a storm. Pun not intended, but I'll leave it because it's clever. He ran off and found the Submariner in the Bowery, right, and shaved off his beard. But since that didn't happen, because the Thing wasn't there to be angry at Johnny, there was no Submariner to find Captain America's frozen body. So there was no Captain America rebirth, and there was no balance to deal with the threat of the Skull. So the Thing gets captured and chained, but gets rescued by Ben Grimm and a group of rebels. And then in a move that is so great, Byrne would use it again in the Captain America Batman crossover years later. The Skull releases his corrosive skull gas, Andrew, and the Thing blows it back in his face, killing him.
Oh, no.
The dust of death is always, when I was a youth, one of the wrestlers was, I think, the Great Kabuki, and he had the mysterious green mist he would spit in opponent's face. And then one wrestler did that back to him one time. Classic moves. Wrestling and comics, you know, they kind of go together.
In the end, the Thing has the same lesson that he learned in 50, which is, you know what? I'm better off being who I am, looking the way I am, in the reality that I'm in. At least I have Alicia. I mean, I could never, ever, ever marry her. he says, but, you know.
That's Johnny's job.
So that's how the story would be a bookend to the series. Isn't that funny?
That's a nice book. I picked 50 also because I have it in paper. And I like to read these because, as you may have surmised, I was not very sophisticated as a youth. So I kind of took everything at a super face level. So now reading these things older, it's quite interesting. Like the bullpen bullet stand soapbox column is all about, yeah, Steve Ditko's coming back. I've been this happy since Jack came back. The big happy bullpen, you know, and as a youth, you're like, oh, that's cool. You know, like they're all back, all buddies and whatever. When, you know, now we know that maybe they weren't all super buddies and really close friends, and the bullpen image wasn't what it was.
They only came back because Stan wasn't there anymore.
And then they only put 2 letters in because they have a big section about, oh, the story's coming up, which we're going to talk more about. But in both letters, they insult the artist. They're both knocks against, and I'm like, now that I know that, like, the editors, some of the letters were fake, and the editors all picked them. I feel like it's kind of those 2 letters to knock the art. You know what I mean? Like,
yep.
They're sending a message that as a kid, I've just been reading the letters like, oh, you know, like, oh, they didn't like him or whatever. Now I know someone was like, yeah, let's put those letters in, send a little message to Kupperman, or who was the artist back then. It was just funny to read. Now that you read these things as an older eye and know that it's not to be taken at face value.
Or sometimes there would be an art change already in the works, yeah. and they would put those letters in as a way to sort of set the stage for it happening, you know, yeah. so you would be okay with it.
Al Kupperberg. Yeah, that's the guy they slam in both yeah. the two letters. And I'm like, it's kind of sad. Let the guy have some respect.
I liked him and Paul over in Crazy Magazine. Well, the Marvel 2-in-1 issue that I wanted you guys to read because of the early Moon Knight appearance was Marvel 2-in-1 issue 52 from the spring of 1979, which has another Perez Sinnott cover. Moon Knight looks like the white tiger in a cape, doesn't he? I'm so used to seeing Perez's white tiger.
Oh, I thought you wanted us to read this because of Crossfire.
Who? No. Oh, jeez. Marvel 2-in-1 issue.
You know that Hawkeye bad guy?
Issue 52 was written by Stephen Grant with art by Jim Craig and Pablo Marcos. The thing is at an event accepting an award on behalf of Reed Richards, and a guy runs in trying to warn the thing and gets shot dead in the thing's arms by a squad of Christmas-colored gunmen.
My favorite is the front page of the Daily Bugle is Reed Richards wins award. And I'm like, wow, what a slow news day.
Yep.
In the above the fold news. But I like how they're, you know, some people didn't like it when they get their news from TV. Well, and the old kids before that trope was old, they had it where they got all their news from the newspapers they were had strewn about the comic.
I thought it's a cleverly laid out
yeah.
splash page, though, because you get the thing there, and you get the newspaper that's already what's telling you what's happening because it's an award thing, right? Rather than having to spell it all out. And in the foreground, in a kind of a neat angle chosen to, I mean, you don't usually get a big civilian face shot on a superhero splash page, but it works here because it's a pretty dynamic shot. You get a guy who's reading that paper who turns out to be Moon Knight in disguise, or not in disguise, I should say, mm-hmm. who's casing out the event. So Moon Knight joins in to help the thing who's fighting with the armed gunman. And this is early Moon Knight, so he's never met the thing. And the thing is, well, he's pretty ungrateful for the assistance.
Yeah, I was surprised at how much the thing's like, oh, this younger generation of heroes, I hate them, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, wow.
Oh, you gotta describe these gunmen, too, Steve. They're not guys in 40 suits with Tommy guns.
No, they've got laser guns and, like I said, Christmas-colored gloves. And the art, though, I think it's really sweet. There's lots of panels here, dynamic figure work. The fight scenes are really well choreographed. When someone does a move, they might take three panels to show the move, but they show it in a good sequence that makes physical sense. I think Marcos's finishes are really nice on Craig's layouts, too. It has a, well, kind of that Pablo Marcos, Armando Gil type of finish to them that I think is real slick. So the dying guy gave the thing an address, but he refuses to share it with Moon Knight.
Yeah, what a guy.
I'm tired of all you Johnny-come-latelys. So the thing, he's got to get to wherever this address is, right? So he hails a cab. and thanks to a quick change in the mooncopter, it's Jake Lockley's cab.
That is so great. I love that. That's actually a good job to have. It's like, hey, I'm a cab driver, so like it ties in so beautifully with the story.
So Grimm gets where he needs to get and busts in and starts busting up some heads and stuff. And he's totally surprised when Moon Knight shows up. Where'd he come from? But the two of them just decimate this crew of commandos. I mean, all the humanity. There's a splash page that where two guys even get knocked out of their uniforms.
I was wondering about that. I'm like, wait a second.
But this body's strewn about everywhere. I mean, they've cleaned town here. But their boss, the big bad of the issue, is Crossfire, and he gasses the thing in Moon Knight. Moon Knight, though, he knows Crossfire from his past. Cross was a senior brainwasher for the CIA who went rogue and built up his own operation and everything, and he wants to mind control the superheroes to take out each other. That's his master plan. So the thing and Moon Knight escape, they chase Crossfire. He tries to control them with his organ that looks like something out of Barbarella.
I like how he's sitting in the chair in that one panel, though, just super relaxed.
Yeah. But Cross, unbeknownst, because he doesn't know Moon Knight's identity, he taught Moon Knight how to resist brainwashing techniques back in their CIA days, including his own. So Moon Knight's able to break free and mess up Cross's plans here. Cross escapes to an elevator and tries to throw a grenade at them before the doors close, but Moon Knight pins his throwing arm with a crescent dart, the doors close, and Crossfire's trapped inside the elevator when the blast goes off. Boom.
Not like this.
You just see the door, like a little bulge in the door. And then in my favorite, the last panel of the book, the thing's like, oh man, how the heck am I going to get a cab from this remote location tonight? And Moon Knight's walking out. It's like, I don't think you're going to have any trouble. Womp, womp. Come on, that's a great team-up book.
And then he'll be like, wow, same cab driver again.
Yeah. Just wait, he's had the meter running, like an airplane, yeah, when that right. meter's running the whole time.
I did not know this was the first appearance of Crossfire.
Yeah, a lot of famous-ish, well, not super famous, but relatively famous first appearances and good old fun around here.
For a long time, this was the only appearance of Crossfire. But it was one of those few issues of Moon Knight that preceded his solo series. There was a couple of those issues in Marvel Spotlight, and then there was this issue, and the Rampaging Hulk backup issues, or, you know, backup stories, and then Moon Knight series. So this was a sought-after book for me as a Moon Knight fan, as a kiddo.
Well, it's fun. He like you say, he's smart, figure out the cap to stay one step ahead so he can contribute, and it's his anti-brainwashing training that saves the day.
And he uses the other personalities or personas as clever tools.
Yeah.
As they were designed to be. It's not some manifestation of delusion and mental illness, right? I mean, it makes a big difference in the character, I think.
I mean, maybe all that, doing all that repeatedly could lead you to some kind of...
Yeah. Yeah, I'd give you a no prize for that, but...
I mean, if I had to keep all those elements, I'm like, I guess that's what I would... I don't know if that's what Marvel would exactly... Like, they would probably just skip to the... No, since he was a child, something happened, and that's... They would probably, like, seed that extremely early rather than...
But this is the Moon Knight that I like. He's street. He's dealing with physical things. We've enjoyed the Khonshu stuff over time, and him having the visitations from Khonshu and having that back and forth happening, but this is... Moon Knight isn't at his best when he's all metaphysical and supernatural.
I'm just happy he has a different job. Like, he's not a doctor or a lawyer or a policeman. Like, if you're a cab driver, you'll hear stuff and you'll be able to do stuff. Like, it's another, like, you don't necessarily have to be like, oh, I'm a journalist or whatever. Like, you can.
There's no deadline.
And if you disappear, like, right. Who cares? You're just a cab driver. Oh my God, you disappeared for like 2 hours. It's like, who, big deal. You didn't make enough money.
There's no one being prepped for surgery.
I mean, I guess nowadays maybe they would have a GPS in your car and they'd be like, right. What were you doing that all time?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He doesn't have to make money. He doesn't have to live. Like, it's just a cover. So if he only drives a cab for an hour a night, who cares? Like, it's just a part-time gig because he's full-time rich.
It's funny because I read to just to segue to modern books, I read the last three or four issues of the Avengers, current Avengers series, the Jason Aaron series, and they just wrapped up their Moon Knight Age of Khonshu storyline that I talked about the first couple of issues, I think the last time we talked about recent books. But issues 36 and 37, with art by Javier Garon, finishes up this arc with, you know, Moon Knight has gathered all of these artifacts of power. He's holding Mjolnir, you know, he's got Doctor Strange's powers, he's got all the, he's powered himself up here. And he's like Moon Knight on the moon. He's like walking around on the moon, which is, I guess it makes sense because it's Moon Knight. But on the other hand, that's so not Moon Knight, right?
It's sort of like that whole Werewolves on the Moon where he was like a Moon Knight. You know that when James Stokoe drew that weird story? It's sort of like, it reminds me of something like that, which is so weird, but it's funny.
One thing that it's funny is that it's Moon Knight who gets to be the character that identifies Nick Fury as this new Watcher guy. Like, he's like, don't I know you? And he's like, wait a minute, I saw you die right here. Like, he figures it out. There's lots of Moon Knight versus the Black Panther in these issues, which is cool because, you know, they're each avatars of their godlike beings. But it's a bit over the top, especially for Moon Knight, and I won't spoil one of the other power sources that he goes to. But at least it wasn't totally disrespectful of Moon Knight or overplaying the mental illness scenario again. Like, Moon Knight was maybe being a little zealous in being controlled by Khonshu, but it was more of a control of Khonshu. It wasn't that he's somehow pathetic or not cool. He's shown to be pretty cool throughout, like, whether no matter which power level he's at, which shifts during the story quite a bit.
Yeah, I think you have to be somewhat competent to do the things you do in this story.
We've seen Moon Knight in the Avengers before, and this story reminds me of why Moon Knight shouldn't be in the Avengers. But it's an Avengers crazy big story, so I enjoyed it, even though it's not really how I like to see Moon Knight depicted.
Yeah, I'm surprised at how much blowback, like, of this Avengers book and then the Spider-Man book get. Like, I feel like this Avengers book is like, maybe it varies a little in quality from arc to arc, but since it began, like, it's pretty big stuff, and I don't know, it's pretty enjoyable. I don't know, I guess different tastes, like, sometimes you don't want to see crazy stuff happening, I guess, or you're like, oh, this isn't, maybe it's not grounded enough or something.
Issue 38 has Ed McGuinness coming back for the art chores, and it's a real catch-your-breath transition issue. More character moments and kind of developing the subplots into becoming the major plot. They give this weird but entertaining history of a family's pact with Mephisto over time, from settling the U.S. time to modern times. There's the return of the Phoenix Force. There's a bunch of fallout from the Age of Khonshu. And they show what could be the birth of Mephisto and the rebirth. Don't get them confused. Mm. But There's a lot going on here, and, you know, Aaron's a good storyteller, especially when he's dealing with things of a mythological, like, proportion. Like, he's weaving a good tale that feels like it's some old history. That's kind of where he's at his best, and I think why he worked so good on the Thor book.
Yeah, I was just going to mention the Thor book. He definitely got that from that book. He's weaving his own stuff together. I mean, not on some other writers that do it a lot more, or even too much in some cases.
I don't know. How many times in this Avengers series have we gotten to see the Sick Celestial, like, throwing up primordial ooze? And that's where we came from.
And I also like those, like, what is it, like 1 million BC, like Avengers in quotes, like, good stuff.
I'm not a fan of making everything a legacy thing. That, like,
it's not really a legacy, though. I mean, I think I take it like that as seriously as, like, it's the Savage Avengers, and I'm like, not really.
The idea that Iron Man and Thor, I don't know. That part is hard for me. I just read it as the fun of the comic and just go with it. But it's that part is hard for me. The legacy thing worked great for Iron Fist. It worked not quite as good, but good enough for Ghost Rider. But it really, I don't like how they're doing it with, like, Venom, and then we got Avengers 1950s, and now Avengers Prehistoric, and I don't know.
Most of the 1950s stuff I notice is usually pretty whack. Like, remember there was that whole, what was it, Neil Adams and that X-Men Sabretooth? And,
yeah.
It, like, that's like, what I mean. I was just like, just stop.
Right.
I mean, the Agents of Atlas works fine in that time period, but I don't know what is. It's just difficult. And the amount of times we reference Namor getting his beard burned off, it's just incredible.
It's one of the greatest moments in comic history.
It truly is.
It's how they brought the Submariner back, for crying out loud. And that started the whole chain of connecting the Golden Age timely stuff to the modern Marvel stuff.
I'll talk about a complicated, long form, very meaty book. So much so I probably would have got more read, but there's a lot going on with Ten of Swords, the X-Men event.
Oh, I haven't even started yet. I've got such a pile. I needed everything. You know, they give you the checklist thing in the back that gives you the reading order.
Yeah.
And that helps, because there's a lot of books. But at least this helped. Like, I needed everything to come out that was supposed to come out before the... Like, I needed the giant-sized Storm and a couple of things that, because of the funny publishing stuff over the last few months, there were a few lingering things that needed to be released. And I kind of wanted to read everything up to X of Swords before I delve in. But tell me, how's it going so far?
I would say that Excalibur turned out to be quite the book that, if you weren't reading... That was probably the extra book. Like, you're probably reading the main X-Men book, right? I'd have to imagine.
Yeah, I'm trying to read them all because I still don't have a sense of which one is which. And maybe that part of that is because of that timeline where you just jump from one book to the next. And it's like, which one is the one with Pirate Kitty and which one is the one with the... You know what I mean? Like, because when I think of who the Marauders are, I don't think of... whatever this current group is being called, Marauders. And when I think of X-Force, I don't think of whoever this current group is. So the titles of the books don't make me think of what's in the book. Does that make sense?
I mean, X-Force is closer than Marauders. Like, Marauders is just... It's funny they actually bring that up in one of the other books. They were like, you stole our name. I mean, I haven't seen any real fisticuffs about that, but it's just... It's just kind of funny. Also kind of sad that, like, with the Hellions, they're like, hey, you guys are a bunch of psychopaths. We'll just send you all out on the same team to get possibly killed. I'm like, that's mean. And then they stick, like, one or two members who, I don't know if they should be. I just, yeah, Havoc is had issues in recent times, but I feel bad, like, when he gets stuck on certain teams, so I feel like Ten of Swords is, and it treats him a little fairly. But if you were going to read one other book than the X-Men book, I would say Excalibur was that book. Even leading up to this, I'm like, stuff was happening in there. I'm like, shouldn't this be important? Like, stuff is happening. And as it turns out, yeah, that was the book to read. Because a lot of stuff that they're doing in that book sort of, like, it was setting up, like, a lot of chess pieces and a lot of a lot of movement. And they get to a big map moment in this, the creation, which is the first part of this event, which every series seems to be taking part in. And it's funny because the covers actually de-emphasize the individual titles and just emphasize that it's Ten of Swords.
Hmm.
Which is an interesting marketing type of thing. So if you're like looking for what is what, it's like that's what you see first. So the like the whole map is like a map of other worlds. And I haven't read a lot of Excalibur, like probably scattered issues. I think it was one of those books I would just skip back in the day. Like if the Phalanx Confluent or something was crossing over with that, like I would be there. But otherwise I wasn't generally like there. But I'm like, I know sort of, it's like when you didn't read a lot of stuff, you would get the trading cards and everything. So you would have base level knowledge of like, these are weird characters that I never see. Or it's like on the cartoon, you would see certain people, but you don't know really who they are. So, I mean, maybe someone with that Excalibur knowledge, they would real like immediately sort of plug into that. But in this great map fashion, it goes into every kingdom of, and then it shows like Earth connecting to other world, connecting to like another world. And it breaks down like who the leaders are, the fair courts, the foul courts. So you have some different areas here, like Avalon, and then the different dudes here that represent the threat. Also, there's an issue just before Ten of Swords. I think it's been Lanyel Yu who's been the artist basically on X-Men. Something, I don't know, something about his art. Like, I generally enjoy him, but it feels like he was miscast for that book. Because it's like a history, real heavy history type of thing of the coming conflict. And it's not that it's boring, but it's just, I needed someone that was more interesting to like be drawing some of that stuff. And it's so strange. But it's like, yeah, if you just had, I don't know who you would put on that book. But it's kind of a detriment, and I'm like, that's a lot of material to go through. And he should be doing action and stuff, and here he is like doing like just trying to impart tons of like historical information.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can totally go into this, I think, without knowing that stuff, but that's just like a mass of like background if you want to know like about Apocalypse, like from the beginning of time type of thing, and like all his kids and like what happened. And it's setting up a lot of stuff. So the artist on, we're getting back to like the Raz from the House of X, Powers of X time. And I think that was with, I guess it was RB Silva that did the other issue, but I think they were really good pairing for those issues. So we have Leraz back for this creation issue, which is pretty nice. So it goes into like setting up the conflict. And I think it's also the Free Comic Book Day thing. Like I didn't check if one part was recolored because I just remember it differently. I should have checked. Maybe it's just my brain, right? But that's sort of in here. And then you sort of get the pages where like you're told something, and then they're sort of like characters are like making their own speculation on what you just read in the issue, which is always strange. Or you're getting like emails or hey, this didn't work out, we should take a look at this in the future, which is very strange. And then the other issue I read was part two, which is also another double-sized thing. And I'm not sure if I know who this Carlos Gomez issue, is, I don't know if I've seen them drawing other things or maybe I just don't remember, but it's for like the first issue, I've probably seen them draw. I don't know. Maybe they did the other X Factor issues. I'm not sure. Anyways, it's pretty good for someone that I'm like seeing for the first time. And in this, it goes into like typical like prophecy stuff. And then they have to get all the stuff. Well, it is Ten of Swords, right? So everyone's going to have to get a sword.
You get a sword. You get a sword. You get a sword.
Exactly. Something else I should have. This might be a bit of a spoiler, but I mean, I think it's. There's been press releases and other stuff out there. So, I mean, I should have figured that something that's called Ten of Swords would also involve sword. Like, you know, the acronym sword. Mm-hmm. Like that seems fairly obvious at this point that I didn't realize that they were gonna get into.
No, that's cool. Maybe we'll get to see what's going on with Abigail Brand.
Yeah, maybe so. Because something's going on. Like you see that giant thing, and you're like, oh, how are they gonna use that? And if they already have the island, and they're convincing, like, well, sort of blackmailing people, hey. Have these drugs, like, I don't think they're gonna be, it's like the Justice League Watchtower being up in space. It's like, hey, why do you guys have this giant thing that, like, this giant powerful thing? And it's like, if people already don't like you or just see that, they'll be like, oh, well, what can you do with that to potentially threaten people? So this definitely goes, sets the whole prophecy swords thing and other interesting things, like, because, you know, some of the books have been dealing with all the different life type of things on the island and all the stuff with the resurrections and all that. So pretty exciting so far, I must say. Like, I know I call it my patented event matrix to see if I'm going to read something. And this one, I'm like, I got to go all in. I think all the signs were pointing towards this is going to be really cool, but who knows? Like, when they increased the size of it, I was like, man, that's a lot of buy-in.
That's the only way to go, Kevin.
I know, right? So I'm feeling pretty comfortable now, and unless this thing totally goes downhill later on, like, it's still sort of in setup mode, but there's so many different moving pieces that it's like, two massive issues later, and it's like you haven't really got there, but it doesn't feel like it's super decompressed or you're just flipping the pages and you were done in 2 minutes. Like, there's a lot of meat to it that you gotta digest and you gotta get through.
And is Hickman steering is he writing some of these issues, or is this when he's leaving, or do we know?
He's always what do they call them, like, not the headmaster, but
yeah, sort of the ringmaster in the back directing things. But he's been writing X-Men and New Mutants and one other book still?
I think he's not on New Mutants. He was only doing those alternate outer space issues, and then he's done now.
And he's been writing some of the Giant Size books, too. He wrote that.
Yeah, all the Giant Size books he's been. But those have been sort of like, I think they describe it as like, what do the artists want to draw too? And those have varied quite a bit, I think, because I think it was the Alan Davis issue that I've enjoyed the least so far out of all of those.
Huh.
Yeah, it's just kind of, and I'm like, maybe that's, I don't know. Like, I guess I have to attribute some of that to the artist, because he's like, what do you want to draw?
Did you read the Storm one? That was written by Hickman with art by Russell Dauterman.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, Dauterman, right?
Well, and they also had that Giant Size that was that Morrison New X-Men issue that was when they went inside. Was it Xavier's brain? The whole Cassandra Nova thing was a silent issue.
Yeah. This one I liked. The Storm one I liked because it referenced the Phantom X Giant Size issue, yeah. Which I really enjoyed. It's like Storm has a techno-organic virus that seems like only mutants ever get. And the cure lies inside the world, which is that Weapon X anomaly environment lab place. And Hickman established a repeating scenario in that giant-sized X-Men Phantom X, where Phantom X, over the years, keeps recruiting different teams to get him into the world and then be fodder for the world's defenses while he gets time to meet with his equivalent of a son who dwells there. So in this issue, Phantom X, Storm, Monet, Cypher, who's, you know, the Doug Ramsey Warlock amalgamation, and a beehive suit-wearing AIM scientist named Ned infiltrate the world. And it's Dowderman, so the art's incredible inside the world and nice and colorful and everything. It's a really, it's a good follow-up to that Phantom X issue. And the Ned character is great because he reminds me how much I really like that personable Hydra agent back in the Deadpool comics.
What was it, like Bob the Hydra?
Bob. I think it was Hydra Bob.
Yeah. The Hydra Bob.
This guy Ned is good. When they first show up at his apartment, he's like in his full beehive suit on the couch with a blanket over his legs, like watching a show.
Don't they kind of have like that when Boomerang is hanging out with Peter Parker, like there's some kind of like that goofy sensibility.
But there's something about that AIM beehive suit, because they're really smart guys, right? Like they're useful. Yeah. They're super smart scientist guys, yet they, you know, you get a bunch of them together and it's the Keystone Cops.
I mean, they're usually evilish, but not in the, like they're science over everything. So that just happens to skew them in a different direction, it seems like, most of the time.
Yeah. When the Skull took over them for a while, they were pretty bad.
So are all these giant size one-shots, they're interlinked then?
No, these were the only two that I can remember had a connection to it.
Okay.
Because I know there were, what, five or six of these things, something like that?
Quite a few. Like there was the Nightcrawler.
Magneto, Jean Grey and Emma Frost, Phantom X, and Storm. I think those are the ones that have been released. I just... being not plugged into the weekly thing, and this I'm gonna have to get in, because I really liked when Hickman first came back and did the two series that were intertwined, and then they launched all the titles, and then Andy stopped going to the comic store. So to get back in, it's gonna be a bit of figuring out what goes with what and what's. So I didn't know if these were supposed to be like kind of annually, kind of just side jobs, or this is part of pushing the story on.
Yeah, they definitely feel like side jobs, but you can never 100% say that they won't tie into something, because like there's weird side stuff where like, oh, Magneto goes to this island, and I can't say that like they'll never go back to that island again.
Oh, I don't mean it that. I mean, in, you know, it's like chapter 7 of this thing.
And no,
it's
directly, no, definitely not.
Like things lead in and lead out directly in contemporaneous. Yeah, I would expect Hickman loves picking up and dropping things. So I would expect there'll be lots of seeds for future stories.
Like, I think most of them are separate most of the time, the titles. But it seemed like a lot of the X-Men issues dealt with stuff that's going to be brewing, especially that Mystique issue. And then there's the Excalibur book, which is definitely heavily referenced, but most of the stuff is just playing around with all the concepts and what would, if this happened, what does this mean? Like, shouldn't there be a culture, or shouldn't there be this, or what about this happening?
Before we leave the X world, I read the first two issues of the new Juggernaut limited series, which is like a breath of fresh air compared to the complexities of the rest of the X world. It's written by Fabian Nicieza with art by Ron Garney. And at first I'm like, when I first saw that this was being solicited, I was thinking, why would I
had the same reaction
want to read another another Juggernaut-centric story, yeah. You know what I mean? Let alone one that's starring Juggernaut. But, you know, Ron Garney art is pretty good. So I thought I would give it a shot, and I really actually have enjoyed the first two issues. The series is simple, it's straightforward, and it's kind of fun. We get to see the Juggernaut dealing with being in and escaping from limbo as like intercut scenes to what's happening now, which we've got this powerful Juggernaut with these red Black Widow movie costume like neon lines all over him, which is a cool look, especially if he's like in the shadows and you can't see everything clearly and you just see those lines and everything. It's pretty menacing looking. He crosses paths with a character called D-Cell, who's a teenage girl mutant, although she's like, I am not a mutant. And her ability is to slow down kinetic motion. So the two of them, like, can't cancel each other out, kind of.
Yeah.
But she's a teen, and she's part of this group of... I can't remember if the other teens have any powers, but she's with a group, like a gang, who are kind of like activists and using social media to show people the truth about things that are happening on the streets. So it's got a little bit of this like kind of modern social media twist on like how reality shows have been used in comic books sometimes. So she connects with the Juggernaut and convinces him to let her help him improve his image and his standing by doing good deeds and having them be filmed and posted on social media. So the first thing she shows him on her phone is the Hulk, nearby and causing havoc. So that's the second issue, is him facing off against the Hulk, and it is totally the current Immortal Hulk. It's very entertaining. Very entertaining. The Hulk beats the crap out of him. it's well done, and there are so few characters in it that it's easy to just check out and enjoy the art, and you don't have to keep too many mental plates spinning in the air while you're reading it. It's kind of like big dumb fun.
Sounds like she should have her villain be Screwball.
I noticed that they're supposed to be coming out with a new X-Men book. Marvel Legends. I got the action figures on the brain. X-Men Legends. And Nicky... I can't say his name now. I'll just call him Fabian. He's supposed to be doing the first issue with Third Summer's brother, in quotes.
Oh, no.
So,
is he going to fix it, though? Because he wanted it to be Adam X, right? The guy who boiled people's blood?
If the story is supposed to be about Adam X, so I'm thinking they're being playful. Because the whole press was release was like, I'm so excited to go to the extreme. So it seems like it might be a funny story with him as the, you know, not realistically as the Third Summer's brother. I don't know, maybe he's the Fourth Summer's brother. 13th. Who knows which order they would have came in anyways. Oy. Man. But it seems like either it's going to be like an Untold Tales of Spider-Man or Marvel Fanfare or like one of those types of books, or it'll be just like a disaster train continuity heavy, you know, hey, why don't we fix something that doesn't need to be fixed type of book. I don't know, I'm kind of interested.
Until the Guthrie father, who left all of the crazy world to just go and be a simple farmer, is revealed to also be a Summers brother. Make mine Marvel. It's coming. Like, if everyone is one of Thor's brothers now. Everyone's a Summers brother. And everyone gets a sword. Or a hammer.
Hey, if you need an extra god, you just whip up one out of Asgard.
That's funny. Speaking of Thor, I've also caught up on Thor's book. read issues 7 through 9, written by Donnie Cates, with art by Aaron Cooter in issues 7 and 8, and regular series artist Nick Klein returns in issue 9. Thor's the Allfather, and he's doing the old, you know, matters of the state are boring to deal with kind of stuff. But he does try to make amends with Beta Ray Bill, who is kind of put off because it's like, you know, you just beat the crud out of me and, yeah, like, broke my hammer last issue.
Yeah, that was pretty bad. I mean, not bad story, like, bad writing. I mean,
At least, it was bad that he did it in the first place, writing-wise, yeah, but at least he's recognizing it and dealing with it, rather than having it just be, you know, forcing the characters into his story. At least he's telling a story out of it, I guess, out of what happened.
Yeah.
And Mjolnir is acting funny, because anyone who picks up Mjolnir can become Thor, and anyone can pick it up, which is what 7 and 8 focus on. They tell this kind of cute little tale of some country fella being granted Thor's power as Thor tests this theory to see if anyone picks it up and will become Thor. And this guy does, and he's like Thor for a day, and at the end of the day gives it up and just wants to fly one time, and Thor's kind of cool about the whole thing. And it's kind of a sweet story. And there's really entertaining interactions with Iron Man throughout the two issues too, because Iron Man is just trying to get control of a situation that he has no control over and doesn't have the ability to strong arm getting control over either. But issue 9 is the one that really caught my attention. Guys, it's downright disturbing. They represent the Don Blake persona, who we haven't seen in years.
Yeah, because we had Jake Olsen instead.
And we have him forever wandering in a perfect world. But Thor goes to visit this world and finds, like, a Lord of the Flies scenario. Like, the world is on fire and everybody's murdered and things are burning, and written on rooftops are like, "Thor, why? Where are you? Why have you abandoned me?" and all this stuff. And you know what happens when Thor goes there? This Don Blake, this version, this incarnation of Don Blake, goes to where Thor was. And he shows up and just trashes Loki. Like, it's really, like, with a doctor's, like, with a surgeon's skill, you know? He's, like, slicing and dicing. It's brutal. And it's really weird. It's really weird, but it's entertaining. The last panel is Don taking the walking stick and saying, "You know what? I'm never going to switch with Thor again," and breaks it over his knee, which essentially you would think is going to trap Thor in that subdimension that he was trapped in and keep Don Blake in Asgard. But this is like savage Don Blake. I'm telling you, this is crazy. He's like going to be gnawing on Heimdall's leg. Or there is no Heimdall, right? It's Sif now. Gnawing on Sif's leg.
Yeah, the way he held that pipe, Steve. He always seemed like he had some repressed issues.
It's true. Just give the guy a lab coat and he'll be all better.
He can join the other team of doctors from that Valkyrie issue.
Yeah, that was cool. Except, wasn't Cardiac part of that group?
Yeah.
Well, in the new Iron Man book, they have Cardiac in the second issue, and it is the most out of character. I mean, first of all, you don't usually see Cardiac outside of a David Michelinie written Spider-Man book, right?
Well, yeah, he looks cool, but no one wants to use him.
But in Iron Man 2, he shows up and he's like the villain of the issue. And he's so, like, he's a murderer. He's so not him. It's, you know, he's murdering people who are like, you know, Big Pharma or something like that, or doctors who don't do good, or, you know, but it's like he was a doctor. I don't know. It was disappointing. I don't know Chris Cantwell from I don't know where what his pedigree is for him to be writing the new Iron Man book.
I think this is just me speculating, sure. But I hear that Doctor Doom book was going over pretty well.
Oh, okay.
And he's also writing that, so I'm thinking that probably led to other things.
Okay. It's a new status quo. It's got a new armor that's designed by Alex Ross, who also does the covers of the series. And the art is by Cafu, who I'm not familiar with either. But
really?
The villains of the first two issues are Terax, who is just used as like a bit scene of Iron Man just totally whooping him, which I thought was a pretty unfair presentation of Terax. The Unicorn...
He gets beaten up quite a bit.
The Unicorn, who we've seen in Iron Man before, and the Absorbing Man, with no respect to the Absorbing Man's recent appearances over the last few years and what his current status quo is.
Weird.
But there's the growing threat of Korvac in the book. That's a big thing happening, and it's funny because it's that whole enclave from the Marvel Comics 1000 books. They are following through on the threads set up there about bringing Korvac into our world, and Korvac, as soon as he's online, immediately kind of takes over the enclave, and the creation is taking control of the creators. But the coolest thing about the book, besides the Alex Ross covers, is Hellcat is a regular supporting cast member. And she's totally regular old Hellcat. No craziness, no armor, no supernaturalness. She's just good old street-level Hellcat. And
does he say cheese and crackers?
But Tony, as a character, whether he's talking to the AI in his armor or to Pepper, or to, like, he needs, because of his personality, he works good when he can be talking to somebody.
Yeah.
And having Hellcat there has been a nice surprise so far. It's been the most enjoyable aspect of the book, I gotta say. Mm. Another great comic book, Redhead.
Yeah, because I was kind of turned off Iron Man towards the end of that other run. And then, like, this was coming out, and I was like, like, the covers look nice, but I was just kind of like, I don't know, like, if I wanted to give another go of an Iron Man book like that. But, you know, some people seem to enjoy it, so, because of Hellcat and all that, so.
So is this off the, like, the Hellcat from the recent, you know, the last few years, they've been taking kind of a, more of a humorous take on the character?
This is Hellcat right out of the Perez-drawn Avengers in the late 70s. Good old-fashioned street-level Hellcat.
Okay.
I mean, I did enjoy that miniseries where she was the only member of, what was it, Alaska? With the 50-state initiative? Like, that was fun.
That was good.
Well, I just remember that Patsy Walker, a.k.a. Hellcat series from a few years ago.
Right.
And that's the last one that was lodged in my brain.
You know what else got lodged in my brain? No, this is a setup for you, Steve. I wanted you to do the heavy lifting.
Uh-oh.
But I guess you could say I've been enjoying Amazing Spider-Man, except for that incomprehensible 29-9 story. Like, even the Kraven stuff, which I wasn't super hot on, like, it was nowhere near a bad story.
I liked it. I thought it was kind of fun.
So, like, and then there's always, like, every few issues, something that I'm really, really into. Like, White Rabbit shows up or whatever. Like, I'm usually really, really into something. So, I mean, that's always great. Like, I'm always like, wow, I want another one of those. And then we go to the next arc, and then I see something weird in it. And, like, I enjoy it, but I'm like, what is going on here? And the whole Sin Eater thing has been, like, one whole, well, he's going to reveal it later on, right? So I'm like, I'm enjoying it, but I'm like, I hope there's a payoff.
Yeah, the Kraven story was the last storyline I really enjoyed, and since then, the 2099 stuff, and really was such a downturn that they haven't won me back yet, because I too don't really care for the Sin Eater stuff. The Sin Eater was only important because of the fact that he doesn't exist anymore, and he was sort of a one-off character, and the whole death of Gene DeWolf and all that stuff. Bringing the Sin Eater back and having him be able to bring other people back and do, I mean, it's just, I don't know. It's too much supernatural for Spider-Man.
It's quite a bit, but I don't know the whole mechanism, so it's hard for, like, I can judge it on, like, did I enjoy that story, but without knowing the, or understanding the whole thing behind, I can't necessarily go, oh, that didn't work, until you get, like, I think you used to talk about an aha moment, right?
There's been this whole long series, long seemingly building deal of the guy being behind it all is this cloaked corpse-like character who wears these maggot worm things and seems to be all powerful. He can float. He can teleport. He can control people. He can bring the dead back to life. He knows everything about everybody. It's got to be going some. That's the piece to me that it's why I keep sticking with it. It's like, well, at some point they gotta like try to tell this story, right?
See, I was sticking with it for like Boomerang and goofing around, because I don't know what really to think about the whole maggots guy. I mean, he shows up sometimes to people and like it's a good story, but still I don't know really what he's supposed to be doing. Like, it's been 50 issues.
The whole series is going to be judged on what happens with that, with this character, though, I think. Because it's been all about that.
But I feel like you could still drop in on certain things. Like, say that didn't work out, you could still drop in on individual stories and enjoy yourself, but then you would have to cut out, like, the other parts if something doesn't work out. And I don't know if the guy telling you, like, if Norman Osborn's telling you something, like, that, like, he's telling you the reveal, I'm like, I don't know if you can trust Norman Osborn. So even though we've gotten somewhere, I don't know if we've really gotten anywhere.
These issues, I read 49, 50, and 51, which are the last three issues, and they're written by Nick Spencer with art by Ryan Ottley and Patrick Gleason as the fill-in. And issue 49 was actually Amazing Spider-Man 850 by the legacy numbering.
Yeah.
So it was like quadruple sized with 60 pages. The lead story had 60 pages.
Yeah, that was a meaty time. And some interesting variant covers on there. They had a Bruce Timm, and it was interesting.
The big bad in the issue is the Sin Eater. It's the conclusion of this whole Sin Eater storyline. But it's like this souped-up Bane out of Batman version of the Sin Eater that, you know, just had me yawning. But the clever piece of it is that he's after Norman Osborn, the Green Goblin, and Spidey and the Green Goblin have to work together to defeat the Sin Eater. And I'm like, suffering Steve Ditko, say it ain't so.
And it seems like Norman becomes more and more sane. So seeing a sane Norman Osborn, like, or a good guy Norman Osborn is weird and disconcerting, but
even the good Norman Osborn, like, as soon as he, how about the creepy scene where he meets Spider-Gwen?
Oh.
And it's like he can smell her. He can smell that it's Gwen.
Yeah. See, that, like, that's almost as bad as like Miles Warren showing up in the Ghost Spider series. Like,
yeah,
total creeps.
And then issue 50 is a merely double-sized lead story, 38 pages of the lead story. And this is the beginning of the Last Remains arc, where we finally get to see what the deal is with this uber-powerful maggot-wearing guy, the Kindred or something they call him, right?
Yeah.
And we do learn who it is, finally.
Is it? Like, how I was
yeah, by 51 you pretty much know.
Yeah, but I was like, I immediately after that, since Comic Book DB doesn't exist anymore, I tried to track down certain things, and I was just like, I still don't know. Like, I know, maybe I don't want to believe.
Yeah, because I was not impressed. Yeah. Like, it really took the wind out of my sails.
Like, there needs to be more of the story that we haven't seen. Like, that was, like, it's not like that, like, that issue says, oh, here, now this is how I win you over. Like, we haven't really had that type of...
How is he so powerful? How is it, what's with the maggots? What, like...
I don't know.
Spidey's at his worst when he's dealing with Mephisto and demons, and this is too much, Kevin.
It feels like a lot.
Next thing, he's going to be walking around with Moon Knight on the moon. These guys should be swinging from rooftops, Kevin.
it's just weird, but I definitely enjoy parts of it more than others, and I like that there's that whole other like group of spider people. Like, I enjoy that. I enjoy them teaming up. So we'll have to see. What do you call that? We'll have to put this verdict to be determined on some of these issues.
I just think it's cool they made it to issue 50, and like it's still got, like, they're not restarting.
They will. As soon as this storyline with this maggot guy is over, it'll be time for a new number one.
Well, now they're doing the. You know what I don't like is the whole LR type of thing, like sort of like the dot one, or like all those things you're gonna forget in the future. I'm just like, ugh, like silly numbering system like that. Or then, didn't they have that during the Kraven? I don't even remember what that system was called anymore. I don't know. It was Doc Kraven or something.
I find that you really don't have to read the point one, those point one issues, because they're telling its own story that actually connect. Like the point one things all go together, and these ones all go together, and that's like a tertiary. It's almost like a tie-in miniseries. That if you do read it, you get to see the Black Cat steal the thing from Doctor Strange's apartment, that then, you know, yeah. Sanctum Sanctorum, where then when Peter shows up and he's looking for the thing and she's got it, and he's like, oh, you're the best, Cat.
Yeah. And Jane shows
you know,
up
you,
again,
you got
too.
To see that. But otherwise, I mean, you know, it's like if you do read it, you'll get more, but you certainly don't need to. And I don't mind them bottlenecking the story. For those of us, I mean, comics are expensive. Not everybody wants to read the tertiary stuff.
Yeah. I found it fine, though. Like, I didn't really see too much of a difference. I guess with different writers, I'm always like, some are hit or miss. So I'm like, I guess Spencer is giving maybe the outline or what he wants the story to be. So I'm always trying to guess what the formula, like what the percentage is between the different writers and everything. Like, it doesn't necessarily mean that, oh, he's going to be handing the book off soon. It like when Slott had Crystal's Gage come in, it doesn't mean that Gage was going to become the regular writer after. It's just interesting.
Yep.
Well, sometimes things run their course. Like, annuals used to be pretty exciting, but I don't really go much out of my way. But they used to be kind of like, whoa, what's going to, you know, cool backups and pinups and stuff. And now I'm like, oh, it's just another. And they can be great stories, but I don't know. I don't have the same excitement I used to.
I never did. So I came in when annuals were already filler. So I've like never had that.
Well, back in the day, we had more continuity with the creative teams on a book. So like an annual was a chance to see like a different creative team work on the character.
Yeah, I feel like that's kind which of was the truth still.
Which was fun.
Plus, Kevin, lots of cutaways. Lots of building. you wanted to see how a building or a boat or some of their equipment worked, man, check out the annual.
I always flip to the back of the book first.
Or like they would have some like Venom four-parter that was going through all the Spider-Man annuals or some weird thing like that. I remember when they tried to make them matter more, and it, like it was like the late 90s or something. They're like, oh, some stories will conclude in the annuals, so you'll want to pick those up because it's by the same creative team. But that didn't last super long.
I also read the most recent last two issues of Daredevil, which are parts 2 and 3 of the current Truth or Dare arc, written by Chip Zdarsky with art by Francesco Mobili in 22 and Marco Cicchetto in 23, where Daredevil's on trial for murder, and these financial mavens are taking over for the Kingpin.
Yeah.
And buying up things in Hell's Kitchen. So in issue 22, I thought it was funny, Daredevil goes to Iron Man and asks him to buy up all of like Hell's Kitchen property to keep out these invaders, corporate invaders. And Iron Man's like, well, that's like not a good investment, you know? And it's just funny to see that interaction go on because Stark is like, well, I don't like those corporate people. I wouldn't mind sticking it to them, but, you know, I'll think about it. But it's almost like it seems like something might come back to that. It's like Daredevil's trying to go around and get people to have his business covered in case he loses and does go to prison. So this way, he's trying to protect Hell's Kitchen by having Iron Man buy a property. And in issue 23, he recruits Spider-Man to help scare the Kingpin and these corporate raiders by seeing that Spider-Man is going to carry the torch for what Daredevil's involved in if Daredevil does go to prison. But the gem of these two issues is this great character scene between Daredevil and Spidey where they're talking about responsibility, and Spider-Man explains how one time somebody died because of something he did, and they talk it through, and it's very well written, and I mean, they even hug. and it's like a good moment. It's like, oh man, Spidey needs a hug here, and they do. You know, Spider-Man and Daredevil together is almost as good as Spider-Man and Human Torch.
Some people argue that they thought Daredevil Spider-Man is more of a thing than, like, they have more in common rather than some weird, like, yeah.
The Kingpin. They have the Kingpin in common.
Well, so once Spider-Man kind of left high school and college, that rivalry with the Torch thing didn't make as much sense as it did, I feel, when they were a bit younger.
Yeah.
We also know that Daredevil's going to return to his landlord-tenant ways. You know, he did a lot of legal work, remember, with the Fantastic Four.
Yeah.
I just keep on thinking back to the first issue where I'm like, I'm not feeling this. And boy, has this book been a really good book. I mean, it had that whole like gang war type of thing. The only weird thing that bugs me is they had that famous, like, I don't even remember what their name is, but they're not supervillains, but they're like one of the most powerful families in the world, but we had never heard of them. That was always, whenever they introduce something like that, we've never heard of, but oh, they're the most powerful. It's always like, then how come we've never heard of them, right? Like in the back of your head, you're sort of like, shut up.
Not to reference the company across town, but I call that the Court of Owls effect.
Right. I mean, it's always kind of been there, and some, like, I remember there was even a Cable story in the 90s where he was taking on some kind of crime dudes, believe it or not, and it was just like, oh, I'm more important than the Kingpin and all these guys, and then I'm like, well, how come we haven't heard about you? But other than some kind of things like that, it's been really exciting.
Yeah, I always run into that sometimes with espionage stuff too, where they get the guy that's behind it, and then they have to have a guy behind that next, and then a guy, you know, they need to have a twist where there's another level of shadow government further deeper in that you thought that they got rid of the first time, that I always feel gets a little tiresome in that realm. Although I like those kind of intrigue, and you can't trust anyone and whatever, but You can only spin those twists so many times.
And it's so strange with New York City because Marvel Comics has so many New York, like, crime bosses and gang lords and all. And it's like, if one of these guys was, like, controlling, like, half the city, it's like, why wouldn't they have, I don't know. They stay above the fray, but it's still.
Yeah, Silvermane would have messed him up.
Yeah.
It's a big city. You can make an empire out of a few blocks.
So you're saying apparently. This is like the Staten Island hammerhead or whatever?
I mean, it works better, too, when you have a lot of people compressed into a tight space so you can extort a lot of people for a lot of money.
Although that being said, I always love the superhero and Punisher, Daredevil, whenever they put him in prison or whatever.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
Because that was
the thing where I'm like, you had the Bendis Daredevil run. And then Brubaker's like, now he's going to be in prison. And I'm like, I think I like these Brubaker prison Daredevil stories better than the Bendis run. It was so good. So good.
All right, let's leave it there. We should retire to our corner so we can come out swinging again next episode. Thank you, Kevin and Andrew, for reading the books and taking the time to tell us about them.
Always glad to be here, Steve.
So many books for next time. We're going to need a 60-page...
That's what I like to hear.
Next issue episode.
Until every member of Spidey's supporting cast has been both dead and resurrected, we're closer than you think, true believers. Make mine Marvel.
Later.
Seems like whenever I think I'm a hero, further behind where I started instead. But now I know that problems have to be solved. But each one brings me down until it's resolved. My problems got problems I can't explain. So pass me the wheat straw. Confusion and uncloud my mind. My problems got problems, you understand. It's like being caught in a sea of quicksand. My problems got problems, I can't explain. My problems got